After that, I treated every moment in the gym, on the ground as well as in the air, as special, worthy of my full attention. Further lessons would be necessary, though, for as Socrates had explained to me more than once, the ability to extend razor-sharp attention to every moment in my daily life would require more practice. The next day in the early afternoon before workout, I took advantage of the blue sky and warm sunshine to sit shirtless in the redwood grove and meditate. I hadn't been sitting for more than 10 minutes when someone grabbed me and started shaking me back and forth. I rolled away panting and stood in a crouch. Then I saw who it was. "Socrates, you have absolutely no manners sometimes." "Wake up," he said. "No more sleeping on the job. There's work to be done." "I'm off duty now," I teased. "Lunch hour. See the next clerk." "It's time to get moving, Chief Sitting Bull. Go get your running shoes and meet me back here in 10 minutes. I went home and put on my old Nike shoes and hurried back to the redwood grove. Socrates was nowhere in sight. Then I saw her. Joy! She was wearing little blue satin running shorts, yellow tiger shoes, and a t-shirt tied at the waist. I ran up to her and hugged her. I wanted to talk, to tell her my feelings, my plans, but she held her fingers to my lips and said, "Time to talk later, Danny. Now, just follow me." She demonstrated a tricky warm-up, a combination of Tai Chi movements, visualizations, calisthenics, and coordination exercises to warm up the mind as well as the body. Without warning, I heard her say, "On your mark, get set, go." She took off, running upwards through campus toward the hill of Strawberry Canyon. I followed, huffing and puffing. Not yet in running shape, I began to trail far behind. Angrily, I pushed harder, my lungs burning. Up ahead, Joy had stopped at the top of the rise overlooking the football stadium. I could hardly breathe by the time I reached her. "What took you so long, sweetheart?" she said, hands on her hips. Then she bounced off again, up the canyon, heading to the base of the fire trails, narrow dirt roads wound up through the hills. Doggedly, I pursued her, hurting as I hadn't hurt in a long time, but determined to run her down. As we neared the trails, she slowed down and began running at a huge pace. Then, to my dismay, she reached the base of the lower trails, and instead of turning around, led me into another grave, far into the distance. I offered up a silent prayer of thanks as she turned around at the end of the lower trails, instead of heading up the agonizingly steep quarter-mile connector that joined the lower and upper trails. As we ran more easily back down a long grade, Joy began to talk. "Danny? Socrates asked me to introduce you to your new phase of training. Meditation is a valuable exercise. Eventually, you have to open your eyes and look around. This is a way of action, and action is not yet." I, meanwhile, had been listening thoughtfully, staring at the ground. I answered, "Yes, I understand that, Joy. That's why I train in gymnastics." I looked up just in time to see her lovely figure disappear in the distance. I was completely drained when, later that afternoon, I walked into the gym. I lay on the mat and stretched and stretched and stretched until the coach came over and asked, "Are you going to stretch all day, Danny, or would you like to try one of our other nice activities we have? We call them gymnastics events." "Okay, Hal," I smiled. I tried some very simple tumbling moves, for the first time testing my leg. Running was one thing, tumbling was another. Advanced tumbling moves could exert as much as 1,600 pounds of force as the legs drove into the ground, thrusting the body skyward. I also began to test my trampoline legs for the first time in a year, bouncing rhythmically into the air, somersaulting. Pat and Dennis, my two trampoline mates, "You know your leg isn't healed yet." I wondered what they'd say if they knew I had just run for miles in the hills. Walking to the station that night, I was so tired I could hardly keep my eyes open. I stepped out of the cool October air and into the office, ready for some soothing tea and relaxing talk. I should have known better. "Come over here and face me. Stand like this," Socrates demonstrated, his knees half bent, his hips forward, and his shoulders back. He put his hands out in front of him as if holding an invisible beach ball. "Hold that position without moving and breathe slowly while I tell you a few things you need to know about proper training." He sat down behind his desk and watched me. Right away, my legs started to ache and tremble. "How long do I have to stay this way?" I groaned. Ignoring my question, he said, You move well, Dan, compared to the average man, but your body is nevertheless full of knots. Your muscles hold too much tension, and tense muscles require more energy to move. So first of all, you have to learn how to release stored tensions. My legs were starting to shake with pain and fatigue. This hurts. It only hurts because your muscles are like rocks. All right, you've made your point. Socrates only smiled and left the office abruptly, leaving me standing bent-legged, sweating and shaking. He came back with a wiry gray tomcat who had obviously seen some action on the front lines. You need to develop muscles like this cat so that you can move like us, he said, scratching the purring feline behind the ears. My forehead was beaded with perspiration. The pain in my shoulders and legs was intense. Finally, Socrates said, At ease. I stood up immediately, wiping my forehead and shaking loose. Come over here and introduce yourself to this cat. It purred with delight as Sock scratched it behind the ears. We're both going to serve as your coaches, aren't we, Puss? The cat meowed loudly, and I patted it. Now, squeeze its leg muscles slowly, to the bone. I might hurt it, Sock. Squeeze! I pressed deeper and deeper into the cat's muscles until I felt the bone. The cat watched me with curiosity and kept purring. Now squeeze my calf muscles, Sock said. Oh, I couldn't, Sock. We don't know each other well enough. Do it. I squeezed and was surprised to feel that his muscles felt just like the cat's, yielding like firm jelly. Your turn, he said, reaching down and squeezing my calf muscle. Ow! I yelped. I'd always thought hard muscles were normal, I said, rubbing my calves. They are normal, Dan, but you must go far beyond normal, beyond usual, beyond common and reasonable, into the realm of the warrior. You've always tried to become superior in an ordinary realm. Now you're going to learn to become ordinary in a superior realm. Socrates petted the cat once more and let it out the door. It hung around for a moment, then wandered off. He then began my introduction to the subtle elements of physical training. By now you can appreciate how the mind imposes tension on the body. You've accumulated worries and concerns and other mental debris for years. Now it's time for you to release old tensions that have become locked into the muscles. Socrates handed me a pair of running shorts and told me to change into them. When I returned, he was in trunks too, and had spread a white sheet on the carpet. What are you going to do if a customer comes? He pointed to his overalls hanging by the door. Now, he said, do exactly as I do. He began by rubbing a sweet-scented oil over his left foot. I copied every step as he squeezed, pressed, and dug very deeply into the bottom, top, sides, and between the toes, stretching, pressing, and pulling. Massage the bones, not just the flesh and muscle. Deeper, he said. Half an hour later, we were through with a left foot. We repeated the same process with a right foot. This process went on for hours, covering every part of the body. I learned things about my muscles and my bones I'd never known before. I could feel where they were attached. I could feel the shape of the bones. It was amazing that I, an athlete, was so unfamiliar with my body. Socrates had quickly slipped into overalls a few times when the bell clanged, but otherwise we were undisturbed. When I donned my clothes 5 hours later, it felt as if I had also donned a new body. Returning from a customer, Sock said, You've cleaned many old fears from your body. Take the time to repeat this process at least once a week for the next 6 months. Pay attention to your legs. Work on the site of your injury every day for 2 weeks. More homework, I thought. The sky began to grow light. I yawned. Time to go home. As I was walking out the door, Socrates told me to be at the base of the fire trails at 1 p.m. sharp that afternoon. I arrived early at the trails. I stretched and warmed up lazily. My body felt very loose and light after the bone massage, but with only a few hours' sleep, I was still tired. A light drizzle had begun. All in all, I didn't feel like running anywhere, with anyone. Then I heard a rustling in the bushes nearby. I stood quietly and watched, expecting to see a deer emerge from the thicket. Out of the foliage stepped Joy, looking like an elf princess, wearing dark green shorts and a lime T-shirt emblazoned with the words, Happiness is a full tank. A gift from Socrates, no doubt. Joy, before we run, let's sit down and talk. She smiled and sped away. As I pursued her up around the first curve, almost slipping on the wet clay earth, I felt the weakness in my legs after yesterday's exercise. I was soon winded, and my right leg throbbed, but I didn't complain. I was thankful that she kept her pace slower than yesterday's. We approached the end of the lower trail without talking. My breathing was labored, and I had no energy left. I started to turn around when she said, "Upsy-daisy," and started up the steep connector. "No," my mind screamed. "Definitely not," said my weary muscles. Then I looked at Joy, bounding lightly up the hill as if it were level. With a rebel yell, I took the hill. I looked like a drunken gorilla, hunched over, grunting, panting, blindly clambering up, 2 steps forward, sliding 1 step back. At the top, it leveled off. Joy was already standing there, smelling the wet pine needles, looking as peaceful and content as Bambi. My lungs were begging for more air. "I have an idea," I panted. "Let's walk the rest of the way. No, let's crawl. It gives us more time to talk. How does that sound? Pretty good?" "Let's go," she said merrily. I struggled over a small hill that seemed like the Colorado Rockies and saw Joy squatting, playing with some wild rabbits as they hopped across the trail. When I stumbled up to her, the rabbits leaped into the bushes. Joy looked up at me, smiling, and said, "Oh, there you are." By some heroic effort, I leaned forward and managed to accelerate past her, but she just shot ahead and disappeared again. We had climbed 1,100 feet. I was now high above the bay and could see the university below me. I was, however, in no condition or state of mind to appreciate the view. I felt very close to passing out. I had a vision of me buried on the hill, under the wet earth, with a marker. "Here lies Dan. Nice guy, good try." The rain had increased, but I ran as if in a trance, leaning forward, stumbling, pulling one leg forward after the other. My shoes felt like iron boots. Then I rounded a corner and saw a final hill that looked nearly vertical. Again, my mind refused, my body stopped, but up there at the top of the hill stood Joy, with her hands on her hips as if challenging me. Somehow I managed to tip forward and start my legs moving again. I plodded, I pushed, I strained and groaned up the last endless steps until I ran right into her. "Whoa, boy, whoa," she laughed. "You're finished, all done." We walked back down the hill, giving me welcome time to recover and talk. "Joy, it seems like pushing this hard, this fast, isn't natural. I wasn't prepared to run this far. I don't think it's very good for the body." "You're right," she said. "This wasn't a test of your body, but of your spirit. A test to see if you would go on, not just with the hill, but with your training. If you had stopped, it would have been the end. But you passed, Danny. You passed with flying colors." The wind began to blow, and the rain poured, drenching us. Then Joy stopped and took my head in her hands. Water dripped from our sopping hair and ran down our cheeks. I reached around her waist and was drawn into her shining eyes, and we kissed. I laughed at the way we both looked, like sponges that needed to be wrung out, and said, "I'll race you to the bottom." I took off and got a good head start. What the hell, I figured. I can roll down these damn trails. She won, of course. Later that afternoon, dry and warm, I stretched lazily in the gym with Sid, Gary, Scott, and Herb. The warmth of the gym was a pleasurable shelter from the pounding rain outside. In spite of my grueling run, I still had a reserve of energy. By the time I stepped into the office that evening and took off my shoes, the reservoir had evaporated. I wanted to flop my aching body down on the couch and take a nap for 10 or 12 hours. Resisting the urge, I settled as gracefully as I could manage and faced Socrates. I was amused to see that he'd rearranged the decor. Pictures of golfers, skiers, tennis players, and gymnasts were up on the wall. On his desk sat a baseball mitt and a football. Socrates even wore a sweatshirt that said, "Ohio State Coaching Staff." It seemed that we'd entered the sports phase of my training. While Socrates made us some of his special wake-up tea he called Thundering Tarnation, I told him about my gymnastics progress. He listened, nodding with approval, and then said words that intrigued me. "Gymnastics can be even more than you've yet comprehended. To help you understand this, you need to see precisely why you enjoy your acrobatic art." "Can you explain that, Soc?" He then reached into his desk and took out 3 lethal-looking daggers. "Never mind, Soc," I said. "I don't really need an explanation." "Stand up," he ordered. When I did, he casually threw a knife underhand straight toward my chest. I leaped aside, falling under the couch as the knife dropped soundlessly to the carpet. I lay there shocked, my heart beating overtime. "Good," he said. "You overreacted a bit, but good. Now stand up and catch the next one." Just then the kettle started whistling, a reprieve. "Well," I said, rubbing my sweaty palms together, "tea time." "It will keep," he said. "Watch me closely." Sock tossed a glittering blade straight into the air. I watched it spin and drop. As it fell, he matched the speed of the blade with the downward motion of his hand and grasped the handle between his thumb and fingers, like a pincer, gripping firmly. "Now you try." Notice how I caught it so that even if I happened to grab the blade, it wouldn't slice me. He tossed another knife toward me. More relaxed, I stepped out of the way and made only a feeble attempt at catching it. "If you drop the next one, I'm going to start throwing overhand," he promised. This time my eyes were glued to the handle as it came near. I reached out. "Hey, I did it!" "Aren't sports wonderful?" he said. For a while we became totally immersed in throwing and catching. Then he paused. "Now let me tell you about Satori, a Zen concept. Satori is the warrior state of being. It occurs at the moment when the mind is free of thought, pure awareness. The body is active, sensitive, relaxed, and the emotions are open and free. Satori is what you experienced when the knife was flying toward you." "You know, Sok, I've had that feeling many times, especially during competitions. Often I'm concentrating so hard I can't even hear the applause." "Yes, that is the experience of Satori. And now, if you grasp what I say next, you'll understand the right use of sports, or painting, or music, or any other active or creative gateway to Satori. You imagine that you love gymnastics, but it's merely the wrapping for a gift within, Satori. The right use of gymnastics is to focus your full attention and feeling on your actions. Gymnastics draws you into the moment of truth, when your life is on the line, like a dueling samurai. It demands your full attention." "Like in the middle of a double somersault," I said. "Yes," he answered. "That's why gymnastics is a warrior's art, a way to train mind and emotions as well as the body, a doorway to Satori. Your final step is to expand this clarity into daily life. Then Satori will become your reality, your key to the gate." I sighed. It seemed like such a distant possibility, Socrates. "When you ran up the hill after joy," he grinned, "you didn't look wistfully at the top of the mountain. You looked directly in front of you and took one step at a time. That's how it works. The house rules, right?" He smiled in answer. As I yawned and stretched, Socrates advised, "You'd better get some sleep. You're beginning special training tomorrow morning at 7 a.m. at the Berkeley High School track." When my alarm rang at 6:15, I had to drag myself out of bed, submerge my head in cold water, do some deep breathing by the open window, then scream into my pillow to wake up. I was alert by the time I hit the streets. I jogged slowly, crossing Shattuck, and cut down Alston Way past the Berkeley YMCA, the post office, then across Milvia, into the high school grounds where Sock was awaiting me. I soon discovered that he had a regular program planned for me, using the principles of Aikido, a flowing martial art. Socrates was able to throw me without any apparent effort, no matter how I tried to push him, grab him, punch him, or even tackle him. "Never struggle with anyone or anything," he said. "When you're pushed, then pull. And when you're pulled, push. Find the natural course and bend with it. Then you join with nature's power." His actions were the proof of his words. Soon it was time to go. "See you tomorrow," he said. "Same time, same place. Stay home tonight and practice your exercises, Dan. Remember, make your breathing so slow that it wouldn't disturb a feather in front of your nose." He moved off as if on roller skates, and I ran toward my apartment, so relaxed that I felt like the wind was blowing me home. In the gym that day, I did my best to apply what I'd learned, letting movements happen instead of trying to do them. My giant swings on the high bar seemed to go around by themselves. I swung, hopped, and somersaulted to handstand after handstand on the parallel bars. My circles, scissors, and pommel work on the horse felt as if I were supported by strings from the ceiling, weightless. And finally, my tumbling legs were returning. Sock and I met just after sunrise every morning. I would stride along, and Sock would run leaping like a gazelle. Each day I grew more relaxed, and my reflexes became lightning quick. One day, however, when we were in the middle of our warm-up run, he suddenly stopped, looking paler than I'd ever seen him before. "I'd better sit down," he said.
"Socrates, can I do anything?"
"Yep." It seemed difficult for him to talk. "Just keep running, Dan. I'll just sit quietly." I did as he asked, but kept my eyes on his still figure, sitting with eyes closed, looking proud and straight, but somehow older. As we'd agreed weeks before, I didn't come to see him in the evening at the station, but I called to see how he was. I was relieved when Socrates answered. "How's it going, coach?" I asked. "In the pink," he said, "but I've hired an assistant to take over for a few weeks."
"Okay, Soc, take care of yourself."
The next day I saw my assistant coach run onto the track, and literally I jumped for joy. I held her gently, hugging her and whispering in her ear. She threw me just as gently, head over heels, onto the lawn. If that wasn't mortifying enough, she beat me kicking field goals, making me, a world champion, blush with shame. I doubled the number of exercises Sock had given me. I trained with a greater concentration than ever before. I awoke at 4 a.m., practiced Tai Chi till dawn, and ran into the hills before meeting Joy each day. I said nothing to anyone about my extra training. I carried her image with me into my classes and into the gym. I wanted to see her, to hold her, but first I had to catch her. For the present, the most I could hope for was to beat her at her own games. A few weeks later, I was back running, skipping, and leaping across the track with Socrates, who was back in action. My legs felt filled with power and spring. "Socrates," I said, sprinting ahead and falling behind, playing tag with him, "you've been pretty closed-mouthed about your daily habits. I've no idea what you're like when we're not together."
"Well?"
Grinning at me, he leaped forward about 10 feet, then sprinted off around the track. I took off after him until I was within talking range.
"Are you going to answer me?"
"Nope," he said. The subject was closed. When we finally finished our stretching and meditation exercises for the morning, Socrates came up to me, put his arm around my shoulders, and said, "Dan, you've been a willing and apt pupil. From now on, you're to arrange your own schedule. Do the exercises as you feel they're needed. I'm going to give you something extra because you've earned it. I'm going to coach you in gymnastics." I had to laugh. I couldn't help it. "You're going to coach me in gymnastics? I think you're overreaching yourself this time, Sock." I ran quickly down the turf and snapped into a round-off backhand spring and a high layout somersault with a double twist. Socrates walked over to me and said, "You know, I can't do that." "Hot dog," I yelled, "I finally found something I can do that you can't." "I did notice," he added, "that your arms need to stretch more when you set for the twist. Oh, and your head is too far back on takeoff."
"Sock, you old bluffer, you're
right," I said, realizing that I had set my head back too far, and my arms did need to stretch more. "Once we straighten out your technique a bit, we can work on your attitude," he added, with a final twist of his own. "I'll be seeing you in the gym." "But Socrates, I already have a coach, and don't know if Hal or the other gymnasts will take to your wandering around the gymnastics room." "Oh, I'm sure you'll think of something to tell them," he said. I certainly would. That afternoon, during the team meeting, prior to workout, I told the coach and team that my eccentric grandfather from Chicago, who used to be a member of the Turner's Gymnastics Club, was visiting for a couple of weeks and wanted to come watch me. "He's a nice old guy, really spry. He fancies himself quite a coach. If you all wouldn't mind and would be willing to humor him a little, he's not quite playing with a full deck, if you know what I mean. I'm sure he won't disrupt workout too much." The consensus was favorable. "Oh, by the way," I added, "he likes to be called Marilyn." I could hardly keep a straight face.
"Marilyn?" everyone echoed.
"Yeah, I know it's kind of bizarre, but you'll understand when you meet him." Rick said, "Maybe seeing Marilyn in action will help us understand you a little better, Millman. They say it's hereditary." They laughed and started warming up. Socrates was entering my domain this time, and I'd show him. I wondered if he'd like his new nickname. Today, I had a little surprise planned for the whole team. I'd been holding back in the gym, and they had no idea that I'd recovered so fully. I arrived at the gym early and walked into the coach's office. He was shuffling through papers scattered on the desk when I spoke. "Hal," I said, "I want to be in the inter-squad competition." Peering above his glasses, he said sympathetically, "You know you're not fully healed yet. I've talked to the team doctor, Dan, and he said your leg will need at least 3 more months."
Hal, I pulled him aside and whispered, I can do it today, now. I've been doing some extra work outside the gym. Give me a chance. He hesitated. Well, okay, one event at a time, and we'll see how it goes. We all warmed up together from event to event around the small gymnastics room, swinging, tumbling, vaulting, pressing to handstands. I started out performing moves I hadn't done in over a year. I was saving the real surprises for later. Then the first event came, floor exercise. Everyone waited, staring at me as I stood ready to begin my routine, as if wondering whether my leg would stand the strain. Everything clicked, the double back, a smooth press to handstand, keeping a light rhythm going on the dance elements that I'd created. Another sky-high tumbling pass, then a final aerial sequence. I became aware of the whistling and applauding. Sid and Josh looked at one another in amazement. Next event, Josh went first on rings, then Sid, Chuck, and Gary. Finally, it was my turn. I adjusted my handguards, made sure the tape on my wrists was secure, and jumped up on the rings. Josh stilled my swing, then stepped back. My muscles twitched with anticipation. Inhaling, I pulled up to an inverted hang, then slowly pulled and pressed my body up to an iron cross. I heard muffled tones of excitement as I swung smoothly down, then up again to a front uprise. I pressed slowly to a handstand with straight arms and straight body. Well, I'll be damned, Hal said, using the strongest language I'd ever heard him use. Bailing out of the handstand, I did a fast, light giant swing and locked it without a tremor. After a high double somersault dismount, I landed with only a small step. And so it went. After completing my final routine, again greeted by hoots and shouts of surprise, I noticed Socrates sitting quietly in the corner, smiling. He must have seen it all. I waved to him to come on over. Guys, I'd like to introduce my grandfather, I said. This is Sid, Tom, Herb, Gary, Joel, Josh. Guys, this is... We're pleased to meet you, Marilyn, they said in a chorus. Socrates looked puzzled for the merest moment, then said, Hello, I'm glad to meet you, too. I wanted to see what kind of crowd Dan runs around with. They grinned, probably deciding they liked him. I hope you don't think it's too strange my being called Marilyn, he said casually. My real name is Merrill, but I got stuck with a nickname. Did Dan ever tell you what he was called at home? He chuckled. No, they said eagerly. What? Well, I'd better not say. I don't want to embarrass him. He can always tell you if he wants to. Socrates, the fox, looked at me and solemnly said, You don't have to be ashamed of it, Dan. As they walked off, they said to me, Bye, Suzette. Bye, Josephine. See you later, Geraldine. Oh, hell, look what you've started, Marilyn. I stomped down to the showers. For the rest of the week, Socrates never took his eyes off me. Occasionally, he'd turn to another gymnast and offer some superb advice, which always seemed to work. I was astonished at his knowledge. After high bar, he said, Dan, you still need to learn to meditate your actions. What do you mean, meditate in action, Soc? Meditating in action is different from doing it. To do, there must be a doer, a self-conscious someone performing. But when you meditate in action, you've already released all thoughts, even the thought of I. There is no you left to do it. In forgetting yourself, you become what you do, so your action is free, spontaneous. On and on it went. He watched every expression on my face, listened to every comment I made. He told me to constantly pay more attention to my mental and emotional form. Some people heard that I was back in shape. Susie came by to watch, bringing with her Michelle and Linda, two new friends. Linda immediately caught my eye. She was a slim red-haired woman with a pretty face behind horn-rimmed glasses, wearing a simple dress that suggested pleasing curves. The next day, after a very disappointing workout when nothing seemed to go well, Socrates called me over to sit with him on a thick landing pad. Dan, he said, you've achieved a high level of skill. You're an expert gymnast. Why, thank you, Socrates. It wasn't necessarily a profound compliment. He turned to face me more directly. An expert trains the physical body with the purpose of winning competitions. Someday you may become a master gymnast. The master dedicates training to life. Therefore, he constantly places emphasis on the mind and emotions. I understand that, Soc. You told me a number... I know you understand it, he interrupted. What I am telling you is that you don't yet live it. You persist in gloating over a few physical skills, then become depressed if the physical training doesn't go well one day. But when you really acknowledge and aim toward mental and emotional form, the warrior's practice, then the physical ups and downs won't matter. Look, what happens if you have a sore ankle one day? Well, I work something else, some other area. It's the same with your three centers, body, mind, and emotions. If one area isn't going well, it's an opportunity to train the others. On some of your weakest physical days, you can learn the most about your mind. He added, I won't be coming into the gym again. I've told you enough. I want you to feel that I'm inside you, watching and correcting every error, no matter how small. During this period, I began seeing Susie's friend, Linda. I was very attracted to her, but had no time or energy to do more than talk to her for a few minutes before or after workout. Even so, I thought about her a lot, then about Joy, then about her, between my daily exercises. Linda and I went out on a few dates and hit it off very well. She came to talk with me about a personal problem one evening and ended up staying the night, but within the conditions imposed by my training. I was growing close to her so quickly that it scared me. She was not in my plans. Still, my attraction to her grew. I felt guilty and awkward sometimes and unfaithful to Joy, but I never knew when that enigmatic young woman would appear again, if ever. Joy was the ideal who flitted in and out of my life. Linda was real, warm, loving, and there. The coach was getting more excited, more careful, and more nervous as each passing week brought us closer to the 1968 National Collegiate Championships in Tucson, Arizona. If we won this year, it would be a first for the university, and Hal would realize a goal of 20 years standing. Soon enough, we were out on the floor for our three-day contest against Southern Illinois University. By the final night of the team championships, Cal and Southern Illinois were running neck and neck in the fiercest race in gymnastics history. With three events still to go, Southern had a three-point lead. This was a critical point. If we were going to be realistic, we could resign ourselves to a respectable second-place finish, or we could go for the impossible. I, for one, was going for the impossible. My spirit was on the line. I faced Hal and the team, my friends. I'm telling you, I said, we are going to win. Nothing is going to stop us this time. Let's do it. My words were ordinary, but whatever I was feeling, the electricity, call it absolute resolve, generated power in each man on the team. Like a tidal wave, we began to pick up momentum, speeding faster and more powerfully with each performer. The crowd, almost lethargic before, started to stir with excitement, leaning forward in their seats. Something was going on. Everyone could feel it. Apparently, the Southern team members were feeling our power, too, because they started to tremble in handstands and bobble on landings. But by the last event of the meet, they still had a full-point lead, and the high bar was always a strong event for them. Finally, there were two Cal gymnasts left, Sid and I. The crowd was hushed. Sid walked to the bar, leaped up, and did a routine which made us hold our breath. He ended with the highest double flyaway anyone in the gym had ever seen. The crowd went wild. I was the last man up on our team, the anchor position, the pressure spot. Southern's last performer did a fine job. They were almost out of reach, but that almost was all I needed. I was going to have to do a 9.8 routine just to tie, and I'd never scored even close to that. Here it was, my final test. My mind was awash with memories. That night of pain when my thigh bone was splintered. My vow to recover. The doctor's admonition to forget about gymnastics, Socrates and my continual training, that endless run in the rain far up into the hills. And I felt a growing power, a wave of fury at all those who said I'd never perform again. My passion turned to icy calm. There in that moment, my fate and future seemed in balance. With the spirit and determination I'd learned in that small gas station over the past months, I approached the high bar. There was not a sound in the gym. The moment of silence, the moment of truth, had arrived. I chalked up slowly, adjusting my handguards, checking my wrist straps. I stepped forward and saluted the judges. My eyes shone with a simple message as I faced the head judge. Here comes the best damn routine you ever saw. I leaped up to the bar and drove my legs forward. From a handstand, I began swinging. The only sound in the gym was that of my hands revolving around the bar, releasing, vaulting, catching, kipping, twisting. Only movement, nothing else. No oceans, no world, no stars. Only the high bar and one mindless performer, and soon even they dissolved into a unity of motion. Adding a movement I'd never done in competition, I continued on, reaching past my limit. Around and around I swung, faster and faster, getting ready for the dismount, a piked double flyaway. I whipped around the bar, preparing to release and go flying into space, floating and twirling in the hands of a fate that I'd chosen for myself. I kicked and snapped my legs, spun around once, then twice, and kicked open, stretching my body for the landing. The moment of truth had arrived. I made a perfect landing that echoed throughout the arena. Silence, then pandemonium broke loose. A 9.85. We were the champions. My coach appeared out of nowhere, grabbing my hand and shaking it wildly, refusing to let go in his rapture. My teammates, jumping and screaming, surrounded and hugged me. A few of them had tears in their eyes. Then I heard the applause thundering in the distance, growing louder. We could hardly contain our excitement during the award ceremony. We celebrated all night, recounting the meet until morning. Then it was over. A long-awaited goal was accomplished. Only then did I realize that the applause, the scores, and victories were not the same anymore. I had changed so much. My search for victory had finally ended. It was early spring, 1968. My college career was drawing to a close. What would follow, I knew not. I said farewell to my team in Arizona and boarded a jet, headed back to Berkeley and Socrates and Linda. I looked aimlessly at the clouds below, drained of ambition. All these years I'd been sustained by an illusion, happiness through victory, and now that illusion was burned to ashes. I was no happier, no more fulfilled for all my achievements. Finally, I saw through the clouds. I saw that I had never learned how to enjoy life, only how to achieve. All my life I'd been busy seeking happiness, but never finding or sustaining it. I put my head back on the pillow as the jet started its descent. My eyes misted with tears. I had come to a dead end, and I didn't know where to turn. Chapter 6. Pleasure Beyond the Mind. Carrying my suitcase, I went straight to Linda's apartment. Between kisses, I told her about the championships, but said nothing of my recent depressing insights. Linda then told me about a personal decision she had made, drawing me, for the moment, out of my own concerns. "Danny, I'm dropping out of school. I've thought about it a lot, of course. I'll get a job, but I don't want to go back home and live. Do you have any ideas?" Immediately, I thought of the friends I had stayed with after the motorcycle accident. "Linda, I could call Charlotte and Lou in Santa Monica." A 5-minute phone call later, Linda had a future. I only wished it would be that simple for me. Remembering Socrates, I abruptly told a very puzzled Linda that I had to go somewhere.
"After midnight?"
"Yes, I have some unusual friends who stay up most of the night. I really have to go." Another kiss, and I was gone. Still carrying my suitcase, I stepped into the office.
"Moving in?" Soc joked.
"I don't know what I'm doing, Socrates."
"Well, you apparently knew what you were doing at the championships. I read a news report. Congratulations, you must be very happy."
"You know very well what I'm feeling, Sock."
"I certainly do," he said lightly as he walked into the garage to resurrect an old VW transmission.
"You're making progress, right on schedule." "Delighted to hear it," I answered without enthusiasm.
"But on schedule to where?"
"To the gate, to freedom, to enjoyment, to unreasonable happiness, to the one and only goal you've ever had. And to begin, it's time to awaken your senses once again."
I paused, digesting what he'd said.
"Again?" I asked.
"Oh, yes. You once were bathed in brightness and found pleasure in the simplest things."
"Not recently," I'd venture.
"No, not recently," he answered, taking my head in his hands, sending me back to my infancy.
My eyes open wide, staring intently at shapes and colors beneath my hands as I crawl on the tiled floor. I touch a rug and it touches me back. Everything is bright and alive. I grasp a spoon in one tiny hand and bang it against a cup. The clinking noise delights my ears. I yell with power. Then I look up to see a skirt billowing above me. I'm lifted up and make cooing sounds. Bathed in my mother's scent, my body relaxes into hers, and I'm filled with bliss. Some time later, cool air touches my face as I crawl in a garden. Colorful flowers tower around me, and I'm surrounded by new smells. I tear one and bite it. My mouth is filled with a bitter message. I spit it out. My mother comes, then. I hold out my hand to show her a wig-leaf black thing that tickles my hand. She reaches down and knocks it away. "Nasty spider," she says. Then she holds a soft thing to my face. It talks to my nose. "Rose," she says, then makes the same noise again. "Rose." I look up at her, then around me, and drift again into the world of scented colors. I'm looking now at Sock's ancient desk, down at the yellow rug. I shake my head. All of it seems hazy. There's no brightness to it. "Socrates, I feel half asleep, like I need to douse myself with cold water and wake up. Are you sure that last journey didn't do some damage?" "No, Dan. The damage was done over the years, in ways you'll soon see."
"That place, it was my grandfather's garden, I think. I remember it. It was like the Garden of Eden."
"Every infant lives in a bright garden where everything is sensed directly, without the interference of thought. The fall from grace happens to each of us when we start thinking, when we become namers and knowers. It's not just Adam and Eve, you see. It's all of us. The birth of the mind is the death of the senses. It's not that we eat an apple and get a little sexy." "I wish I could go back," I sighed. "It was so bright, so clear, so enjoyable." "What you enjoyed as a child can be yours again. Jesus of Nazareth, one of the great warriors, once said that you must be like a little child to enter the kingdom of heaven. Now you understand." "Before you leave tonight, Dan," he said, filling his mug from the dispenser, "would you like some more tea?" "No, thanks, Sock. My tank is full for tonight." "Okay, then. I'll meet you tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. in the Botanical Gardens. It's time we went for a nature hike." I left, already looking forward to it. I awoke after a few hours' sleep, refreshed and excited. Maybe today, maybe tomorrow, I discover the secret of enjoyment. I jogged up into Strawberry Canyon and was waiting for Sock at the entrance to the gardens. When he arrived, we walked through the green acres of every kind of imaginable tree, bush, plant, and flower. We entered a giant greenhouse. The air was warm and humid, contrasting with the cool morning air outside. Sock pointed to the tropical foliage that towered over us. "As a child, all this would appear before your eyes and ears and touch as if for the first time. But now you've learned names and categories for everything. That's good, that's bad, that's a table, that's a chair, that's a car, a house, a flower, dog, cat, chicken, man, woman, sunset, ocean, star. You've become bored with things because they only exist as names to you. The dry concepts of the mind obscure your vision." Socrates waved his arm in a sweeping gesture, taking in the palms high above our heads that nearly touched the plexiglass canopy of the geodesic dome. "You now see everything through a veil of associations about things, projected over a direct, simple awareness. You've seen it all before. It's like watching a movie for the 20th time. You see only memories of things, so you become bored. Boredom, you see, is a fundamental non-awareness of life. Boredom is awareness trapped in the mind. You'll have to lose your mind before you can come to your senses."